So in a time when everyone is expected to stay safe while they go about their normal activities, we still cannot help but talk about the basic sporting or the major sporting events in the world. A lot of things happening around all the major sports. Once again, this is your favorite sporting show on radio and also on YouTube. It's News Instant Sports coming to you live on Urban Radio Scope. Also broadcasting live on all the available podcasts on Apple, on Spotify, and also on Amazon. You can also get to watch us live, watch us on YouTube. If the voice sounds different, it's because I'm standing in for our regular host, Adebawale. My name is Onyeka Chinwande, aka The Oracle. Today with me, I have half of the gang. Sheyi Ajayi is here with us, and we also have Olawale. Let me start by asking Olawale to say one word to the fans.
Good day, sporting fans around the world. Welcome to the show. Debo is afraid of coming to the show today. I guess Arsenal lost the FA Cup match. That's why he's hiding his face. But be rest assured that you are going to have you are going to enjoy yourself with us today.
Thank you very much, Ashay.
Yeah, hello, sport fans around the world. Welcome to this week's edition. I'm very sure you're going to enjoy yourself, and also the African Cup of Nations started over the weekend, and I'm sure we'll be touching up on one or two things on that also. Welcome, everyone.
Thank you very much. You are absolutely right. We will be touching on some of the major events that has happened in the AFCON so far to keep those of you who are interested in that tournament abreast of the event. But where else can we start except with the Novak Djokovic saga? It's looking or shaping up to become an embarrassing event, not just for the Australian government, but also for the camp of Novak Djokovic. Novak, we mentioned this during our show last week, that he was going down under. He had been given a little pass to participate in the tournament, but due to a public outcry from the citizens of Australia, Novak was held back at the point of entry. From all we know, he's scheduled to be deported pending the outcome of an appeal by his lawyers. Olawale, I'm going to start with you here. And especially because of the comment I heard from one of the other people participating, which is Rafael Nadal. Rafael said, yes, even though he feels sorry for him, but Novak had known about the Australian government's policy many, many weeks before embarking on that trip. And if anything is happening to him, then the fault is his and his alone. I guess for me, my question is, do you think Novak has been fairly treated by the government, the Australian government, by denying him entrance? Secondly, and maybe I will let you go through your response and see the second question, but to you directly, your personal opinion, do you think that Novak Djokovic is right in demanding that he is allowed entry, especially when he did not let us know that he contracted COVID for the second time in December, and is using that as an excuse to say he will not be vaccinated?
Yeah, thank you, Kachi. I think it's even a question of, is Novak Djokovic actually fair to the rest of the tennis fraternity and the Australian government? Because just like Rafael Nadal said, he's aware of the situation. Everybody knows around the world that the Australia as a country, they have one of the strictest COVID-19 restriction. This thing around the world, and their citizens have been living under age restriction for more than 1 year now. So most of them bring themselves into the fact that an outsider is getting this kind of waiver. For me, I even question the whole waiver thing. Right from the onset, I think he shouldn't have even gotten the visa that will make him, what do you call it, enter Australia in the first place. And not talk of him now trying to clear himself with the Australian immigration, what do you call it, authority. As far as I'm concerned, he knows what he's up to. And I think all these, he has his plan right from the onset. He knows how this whole thing will play out. He knows it's going to need, what do you call it, input from lawyers. He was ready to, I think he's ready to fight dirty. Mm-hmm. He's ready to fight dirty. Because even the grant that he's using to get a medical exemption, which is that he contracted COVID, not many people question whether he was even aware that he had COVID during that time, which means it was just a flimsy excuse on his part. Mm-hmm. It's for me, it's an insult on the whole, or on the whole country. It seems you don't respect them. Nobody is stopping you from, if you want to be anti-vax, fine. But at the same time, that's your freedom to choose. But at the same time, you should know that there is consequence to this, the choice you've already made. Mm-hmm. People will react in a different way. It's just like if you on your own might say, okay, I don't want to take vaccine.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
In my own house, I might say, if you don't take vaccine, you can't enter into my house.
Exactly.
So you can't tell me that I'm not fair to you. It is my house. It is my house. I have the right to do whatever I want to do. The same thing is happening to, and that's why I respect Kyrie Irving a lot. In as much as we might have different, what do you call it, opinion about his stance. But he's a kind of a guy who has not tried to use the back door to get away with the consequence of his action. He has whatever decision the New York government has taken, he has abided by it, and he is not trying to use one legal way or one. So for me, I think I'm highly disappointed in Novak, and I think he has not been treated any way badly. He has been the one that has put other people in a very difficult position.
Thank you very much, Olaole. I share a lot of your sentiments, especially seeing how his parents, his dad, his mom have been coming out to paint the government of Australia in such terrible light. We recently found out, we saw pictures of the food he was being served at the isolation center where he's being held. I'm not sure why such a picture. Should make the news. He's not the only one there. I found out that there's another tennis player participating in the tournament from Czech Republic, I believe, also in the same holding center. I will come to you, Shay, here. And I guess my question really for you is, seeing how sensitive this topic is and the whole issue at hand, Nadal came out to say, whatever is happening to Novak is most likely his fault because he had been informed many months before now. But also Andy Murray, another person who will be playing in the tournament, came out to somehow defend Novak Djokovic by saying that what is happening is bad for the sport of tennis and also a dent on the reputation of Australia. Shay, do you think competitors, especially those who will most likely play against Novak or benefit from his absence, should have a public opinion? I'm not saying should they have an opinion. Should they have a public opinion and voice this opinion publicly? Or do you think they should just keep their thoughts to themselves and whatever they see, they deal with? What do you see in this scene?
Yeah, thank you, Kachi, and big ups for you for standing in for Debo today.
Thank you. Debo will pay for it.
Okay,
don't worry.
Going back to your question, I think as a professional, you need not to discuss anything that is not cast in stone, and also, something that a fellow professional is undergoing, it would be wrong for anybody to come out and say anything about it. Talking about the other stars, they've done what is necessary for them to be on this stage, mm-hmm. and they are, I think they are worthy contestants as far as I'm concerned. And anybody that goes ahead to win this particular tournament, I really, really respect them. Coming back to Novak Djokovic, just as Olawale has really dissected this issue, mm-hmm. I think he knew what he was doing. And for him to have tested positive around December 16, and I also heard that around that period, he actually went to a public gathering around that period. And which even really it means it does not care about everybody else out there. So I think he's supposed to be responsible for anything, all his actions. We mentioned this last week that are we going to support if the ATP decided to issue an exemption for mm-hmm. Djokovic. And if you remember very well, I said I'll be disappointed. So I'm really happy that this is happening to him. Even if he wins this case and eventually goes on to play, it means that at least a particular body is ready to stand, to make a stand, you understand, mm-hmm. as regards vaccination against this COVID-19. The other contestant you mentioned earlier, the Czech lady, Renata Vrakova, I learned that she has actually left Australia, I think, yesterday or some days back. She has actually left because she has accepted what has happened. And I believe that Novak will want to stand for himself, go to the court and see if he's going to get a positive result. Let us see how that happens. It's just a few hours away. You mentioned something about Andy Murray supporting him. I think mm-hmm. everybody has, their opinion on this matter. But I would rather prefer what Rafael Nadal said, because this is a 20 Grand Slam winner also. He has traversed several generations when it comes to tennis. And for him to come out to say that, I really tend towards what Nadal is saying. You know this is going to happen. Everybody, when you are going to another country, you read about them. You really know what is going on over there before you go. So for someone as important as that to decide to go against it, I think I'm disappointed, and I'll stand with the Australian authorities on this.
And it's very interesting for our listeners to know this. And first of all, thank you very much. It's interesting for our listeners to know that the issue of granting of visas is actually done at a state level, so to speak. So the state where the tournament would hold were the one that issued Novak the invitation to come in, but actual border entry is not a state's issue. It's a federal issue. The border agents, the customs agents, work for the federal Australian government and not for the province or the state. And that's why they were like, okay, if your state can prove that there's actual proper medical exemption for you to come in, then we would allow you in. But I tend to agree with you, Shehi, that Novak is beginning to make this very political, especially as the organizers of the French Open also came out to say, they would allow Novak Djokovic to come and contest in the French Open tournament. I guess my fear, really, as somebody who is more a supporter of Rafael Nadal than I am of Roger Federer or Novak Djokovic, my fear is that should, in case Novak does not win it by not being into the tournament, and Nadal ultimately gets to 21 before him, that there will be no conspiracy theory as we have in the NBA, that the fourth ring that LeBron James won is made of Rubik zirconia and it's not proper gold because it's a bubble ring. Just before we move out of this topic, do you think if Novak is not allowed in the tournament and someone goes on, not someone, and Nadal goes on to win and get to 21 before him, do you think, Shehi has already told us the person will be a worthy winner. In your own opinion, would the person also be a worthy winner? If it happens to be that bad, by the way.
Of course, there is no asterisk there. Mm-hmm. Injury happens. Okay. It's not something that could have been that is easily avoidable if he actually wants to avoid it. And but on a normal day, it is not like whether Nadal. I don't know their head-to-head record, but I'm sure if Nadal is not leading, it should be something very, very close. So it's not a matter of let's put it like this. If it was to be a French Open that Nadal has been dominating, probably has won 90% of it or 95% since he started his professional career. That is the one we can easily question. But Australia Open, I think Nadal himself has won a couple, I'm not sure the numbers, probably three or four. And in terms of head-to-head record with Novak, it is not something that I'm not sure Novak has any, upper hand. Even if he has a superior record, I'm not sure it's going to be by a big margin that one will question. If he's participating, Nadal can still beat him. It's something that is very possible. So there won't be any asterisk on Nadal's title if Novak doesn't participate and if eventually he wins it.
Thank you very much, guys. Let's segue quickly to the NBA. With a lot of very cheery news coming. First is the return, was the return of Kyrie Irving to the Brooklyn Nets, playing outside of Brooklyn, coming back and scoring about, I think, 26 or 29 points in his first game back, even though the Nets lost the game. And also the return of Klay Thompson against the Cleveland Cavaliers. These are two elite players. Both narrowly missed the NBA 75 top list. My take for you is this. When the Nets lost, they asked KD, based on the fact that you are losing now, do you think that you will persuade Kyrie to get vaxxed? But that's just a single thought. But the most important one is, we thought that with the return of Kyrie, at least for the away games or also for games in cities where they don't have stringent COVID regulations, that the Nets will be better. But that hasn't been the case. They've been losing games they should win against smaller teams. They've also been losing games against the bigger teams. So what really is the issue with the Nets, Olawale?
Now, as far as the Nets is concerned, I think for whatever excuse we are trying to make for them, I think the Nets are who they are. And this is what they are going to be for the rest of the season. It's part of it could be a coaching problem. Part of it could be the construction of the roster. And part of it is down to James Harden's production, which has not up to what we know James Harden to be. He has not been consistently, offensively, he has not been up to it. And in that sense, there seems to be not too much hope for them, because defensively, everybody knows they are not up to it. For everybody that tipped the Brooklyn Nets to win, we tipped them to win because of their offensive power. With Kyrie not there, that's a huge miss for them. With James Harden not producing up to his standard, that means there is no hope for the Brooklyn Nets. It seems the Milwaukee Bucks are going to win the East. But with Kyrie partially coming back, because now he's eligible to play on the road games, and we saw him against the Pacers. He scored 22 points, I think, in 32 minutes. He was a bit rusty in the first 10 minutes. What this means for the Brooklyn Nets is there is a bit of hope. With Kyrie, you know, you have somebody who could share the offensive burden with Kevin Durant. Why they still hope that James Harden can probably get back to his best. So far, so good. I think Kyrie will give them a bit of hope, but it's still, for me, they are still not looking too good. I'm still probably by now, as it stands, I'll still tip the Milwaukee Bucks ahead of them. But Kyrie coming back gives them a bit of hope. Without Kyrie, there is no hope.
And it's really interesting you say that, but my concern is if they end up being the third seed, for instance, because, I mean, the Chicago Bulls, we know right now they are the form team in the East. The Milwaukee Bucks seem to be rediscovering their form. The 76ers are also kind of similarly bouncing back from whatever issues they had at the start of the season. If they happen to be the third or fourth seed, it means that they will most likely get three games when they're going to play the second, third, and first seed. Three games in Brooklyn, four games outside, and chances are they may not win all three. I'm a bit concerned, and it's probably not something we need to discuss here, but yes, don't you think teams can now say, oh, it's playoff time, we're going to rejig our policies to even make sure that away games, they don't even have Kyrie. I know in sports, especially in American sports, different things can be done to give their home teams a competitive edge. Do you agree that it's a risk if teams ultimately change their policies to make sure that Kyrie doesn't even play even in those away games?
Now, what you just said now is something that probably crossed my mind some couple of weeks ago. I think on the part of the teams, it might be difficult for them to make such stand because NBA issue is more of a collective bargaining. It has to be a league-wide decision. But where it could be a problem is if they can now use the influence of their respective governments, either locality or at the state level, to check the Brooklyn. It is very possible, highly possible. And that was why I was a bit concerned, as in I was a bit surprised that the state of New York having a chance to bring home one of the major championship in American sports. Because with this Brooklyn Nets, you know, within the next 1 or 2 years, they are more likely to win one of those championships. Mm-hmm. And with the States coming with such a very aggressive, I know that's because of the old citizen, but I think the Brooklyn Nets, I was expecting them to do a bit of lobbying, not at least to make a bit of exemption for their own ground from that rule so that they can have all their superstars in play. But like you said, everything is fair in love and war. Let me say they are playing a Milwaukee Bucks, and tomorrow I won't be surprised if the government of Wisconsin comes up with the law banning an outsider for so just to give their team advantage.
Yes.
Yeah, it's very, very possible, and some team could take advantage of that.
Okay, thank you very much, Wale. I mean, it shows that I'm not the only one thinking conspiracy theory here, and I truly appreciate it. Let's move to the Lakers. So AD got injured. Dwight Howard injury, I think it's under the protocol, COVID protocol. DeAndre Jordan has not been pulling his weight. And the Lakers went small ball, starting LeBron James at center and pairing Russell Westbrook with really stout shooting talent in Malik Monk. THT also coming into his own, and they went on a 4-win streak. First time the Lakers will win 4 straight games on the bounce this season. In the same instance, LeBron became the 10th all-time in the number of steals when they played. I think it was during against the Atlanta Hawks. LeBron also got his 15th 30-point game this season. What do you think? Do you think that is what the way the Lakers should go? Small ball? And if you say so, what does this mean for AD when he returns? What kind of message does this send to AD? Can you see the biggest star of the team willing to sacrifice his numbers, his statistics to play center, and you are refusing to play center? Or is he going to remain on the bench and become a sixth man, similar to what Carmelo Anthony is doing? Wale, back to you again.
I think when AD joined the Lakers, I think at the beginning of 2019-2020 season, I think he made it clear to everyone that he's not prepared to play the center. Mm-hmm. And I think that's because of the physical nature of playing in that role. I think AD wants to have more impact on the game outside the perimeter, not just within the paint. So, but for the Lakers, there have been a lot of debates if they play better when AD goes to the center and allows them to spread the floor more. I think as of today, LeBron playing center might be good for what they have. But when AD comes back, I don't see LeBron continue in that role. But for AD, if AD playing in the, at the center is what will probably make the Lakers more of a team that we expect them to be, I think against his will, he might probably have to take it because the way the whole season is going is not good for everybody, not good for the Lakers organization, not good for even in the AD's image, because as much as the focus has always been on Russell Westbrook performance and decision-making in games, a lot of people have said AD's performance has been another big reason why the Lakers have not been performing up to what they are supposed to perform, because we've not seen much from him. So yes, if he moves to the center against what he actually wants, it's what will save their season. I think just have to do it.
We have to agree. All his numbers have dropped. His free throw shooting percentage has dropped to below 70%. His three-point shooting percentage has also dropped to below 30%. So everything tells me that in trying to be a perimeter shooter, even though he has the talent for it, he's hurting the team more than helping them. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll go into the world of boxing. And after boxing, we'll talk strictly football. Join us when we return. Welcome back to the show. We're moving straight to boxing. A bit of exciting news. It looks like Anthony Joshua will ultimately get his rematch against Alexander Usyk, the man who beat him blue-black the last time they fought. Fillers from Eddie Hearn is that the rematch between Usyk and Joshua would most likely be slated for April 2022. Shay, do you have a bit more insight on the possibility of this happening, especially with everybody thinking that maybe Usyk should just go and fight Fury and unify this belt in that division once and for all? Shay?
Yeah, thank you, Kachi. Of course, we don't expect Usyk to go ahead and fight Fury like that. There is a rematch clause in the first fight, which he had decided to honor. And of course, for him beating Anthony Joshua in that particular fashion, you will have that confidence to know that even the second fight, you should be able to beat your opponent. So mm-hmm. that's a mark of a true champion. Talking about Anthony Joshua, decided to change his trainer also, yes. I think around December thereabouts last month. And he mentioned something which is key for his professionalism. He mentioned that he has been a loyal athlete, which I completely agree to that. He's a former coach, his former trainer has been his trainer since his amateur days and helped him to win the world title twice. And I respect him for that, to stay with the coach for that long until now. He actually needs something different. Otherwise, he's going to be taken apart by Alexander Usyk. From the first fight, we could see that Usyk is a lot more faster, has more technical ability than Anthony Joshua. So he needs a different trainer. He needs something different. He has to be on that stage on the day of the rematch and be a different Anthony Joshua completely to be able to regain his bout. So I think that is fine by him. He's also shifting his his training camp also. Oh, he's leaving Sheffield. He's looking at either Dubai or even coming to Africa. Probably Abeokuta on a lighter note. So he's trying to change a lot of things so that he can get back on that stage and win back his world title. Kudos to him on that.
Thank you very much. Still in that division, I understand that Tyson Fury will probably, he's been mandated by I think it's the WBC to fight the number one contender in Dillian White. Possibility of this fight happening also in the first half of the year is there. But I think there are a lot of background noises concerning that fight. Shay, is this something you can shed more light on?
Yes, Karachi. Actually, what happened is, you know what they say about money? Money makes the world spin. Mm-hmm. The post splitting when the fight was put together by WBC was supposed to be 80 to the champion, we're talking about Fury, yeah, and 20 mm-hmm. to Dillian White. And Dillian White actually thinks that is a disrespect to his professionalism over the years, and also having to go through a lot of things to even be the number one challenger in the WBC. And he's fighting for that at the moment. This, according to the professionals, they say that if you're number one challenger, actually the purse could go as high as 55-45. Okay. In fact, 55-45, of course, being the champion, you have to have a bigger purse. And I don't see that happening, to be sincere. But they've gone to court. They're looking out to get something bigger than what is on the table. And if that does not happen, Fury is looking out for two opponents, looking at Elenius. Elenius is an European, and he's looking at fighting Elenius at probably Manchester in England. And if that's not going to happen, he's looking at Andy Ruiz, who I think is a tricky opponent mm-hmm. at the moment because of his abilities and also because of his coach. We're talking about Renault. So that's the trainer of
Canelo
Alvarez.
Yeah, Alvarez.
So I think I think I'd rather see that kind of bout if we are not going to be seeing Fury and Dillian White. But I still think that should be able to be settled at the end of the day. But if time does not permit them and Fury needs to defend his belt, then they'll definitely pick one of the two. Most likely, I think Elenius will be the easiest opponent for Fury to take apart. And he's going to be also in his hometown, Manchester, most likely.
Okay, let's talk hypothesis here. If hypothetically the fight between Usyk and Joshua happens in April, and one of those guys win, or even Joshua wins, retains or recovers his belt from Alexander Usyk, a very high probability, but then, and this debacle with Dillian White and Fury persists till even after the fight without being resolved. Do you think there's any possibility that the boxing world can prevail on these two British people to give us what would potentially be a fight bigger than even the trilogy we saw between Fury and Deontay Wilder? Let's just talk hypothesis. Can this hypothetically happen?
Yes, it can definitely happen, but a lot of things will have to be put into consideration, and there will be a lot of people that will come to the table to take stepping down money. Dillian White is number one challenger for WBC, so it will always be in the equation. Even if Fury decides to go ahead and fight Elenius or Andy Ruiz, Dillian White will still be waiting for him. That is exactly so. That is set. Now, if Anthony Joshua happens to regain his bout, because he signed probably only a two-match fight with Usyk, the best thing for him is to just run away and look at another opponent. If he loses and Usyk wins, yes, there is a high possibility of having the undisputed fight. But like I said, a lot of people will have to sit down to the table and take money to step down. Because talking about WBO last, I think it was 2 weeks ago, we just Joseph Parker also had his win to become the number one challenger for the WBO heavyweight title. So we have a lot of people behind like that that will be waiting to either have a chance at being a world champion or they have a chance to make some money over the undisputed bout.
It's looking like 2022 is shaping up to be another interesting year in the world of boxing. And just before we leave boxing, the famous YouTuber who is now making more money fighting former sportsman Jake Paul has said that he wants his next fight to be against a real boxer. I don't know who he means. Everybody has been saying he should try and fight someone like Canelo Alvarez. I'm hoping that happens so that that man can be shut up finally. From there, we'll move on to the world of football. We're not going to take a break, guys. We'll just move on straight. And we'll start with a tournament that is close, if not dear to us, it is at least close to home. And that is the African Cup of Nations tournament, which commenced over the weekend in Cameroon. Cameroon, the host nation, played Burkina Faso in the opening match of the tournament and required two penalties in the space of 5 minutes taken by their captain, Abubakar, to defeat Burkina Faso. The first penalty, the equalizing penalty, had to be given by the VAR. It was clear cut. I mean, I saw it. It definitely was a penalty. Not sure why the referee was scared to blow it in the first place and needed VAR. The second was slightly debatable, but still a penalty. It could have gone either way. And the referee took the decision himself. Overall, I was impressed with the pitch in the first 10 minutes before all their hard boots dug up all the earth. So it's going to be a big work for the tournament organizers to bring the pitches back to a playable condition for the duration of the tournament. Just before we move to other things, guys, the major problem we've always had about AFCON, apart from the death of stars, has been the quality of play. The group stages have always been a snooze fest until we get to the knockout phase. And Olaole, I will start with you. What do you think? What do you think CAF can do? When it was 16 teams, people were having these complaints. Now it is 24 teams, and we're probably going to see more one-goal games or new games before we get to the business end of the tournament. How can CAF revamp this? Your opinion, Wale?
Yeah, the only way to revamp this is for them to go back to 16 teams, which they will not do. You know, CAF has always been, there is nothing original about CAF. I'm sorry to say. Yes. It has always been a copycat organization, right from when Europe has three tournaments, club tournaments. Mm-hmm. They call it the Champions Cup, European Champions Cup, the Cup Winners Cup, and UEFA Cup. Mm-hmm. CAF, then they have the African Champions Cup, then we created Cup Winners Cup. Mm-hmm. Then in 1992, we now had what they call the CAF Cup to CAF match Cup, yes. The UEFA Cup of this thing. Mm-hmm. Then mm-hmm. when UEFA now decided to say, okay, based on their own, knowledge, as in based on their own situation, they decided to scrap the Cup Winners Cup and make it Champions League. Okay, when they change their name from Champions Cup to Champions League, we change our own name to
CAF changed it to CAF Champions
Cup to CAF Champions League. So when they scrapped Cup Winners Cup, for reasons known to them, we too decided to scrap our own Cup Winners Cup, without anything. We just want to follow whatever they do. So we left it with CAF Cup, Champions League and the CAF Cup. Even when Europe now modified their own UEFA Cup to Europa League, which we tried to, so it has always been, up to year 2000, when there was FIFA, the reason why FIFA did a co-host in 2002 was because doing the bidding stage, there was virtually nothing between Japan and
Japan
Korea.
And South Korea. If they
gave it then to Japan, it would have been unfair to Korea. If it was given to Korea, it would have been unfair to Japan. That was why FIFA just decided to say, okay, let's do a poll host. Probably to do a test run before then, and UEFA already looking at, they have a lot of smaller nations, the kind of cost involved in hosting tournament, they decided to do Belgium
co-host Netherlands
in 2000. What did CAF did?
They did Ghana, Nigeria 2000.
They said Nigeria. Nigeria that just hosted the whole world in 1999 for 24 nations. They said both Nigeria and Ghana doesn't have enough resources to host a tournament. Just say you want to copy. So going back to, don't let me deviate too much. You see, the problem is CAF, it has always been about copycats. And that is why there is no originality. Like you said, even when it was 16, we still complain about, for me, when it was even 16, my own suggestion was, let us play this tournament in some few countries, Tunisia, Morocco, Egypt, South Africa, and probably one of these, probably Nigeria, if Nigeria was probably serious, because those countries can give us very good pitch. They can give, they have the facilities, the infrastructures to at least to have a very decent tournament. I don't like situation whereby you go to countries whereby they only have one playable pitch and they just try to bring one or two or three together. If you go back to Mali 2002, it was horrible to watch.
Yes.
And even Ghana 2008 was another one. Zimbabwe, was it? I think it was Zimbabwe 2010. So it has always been like that. And then we complain about the pitch, we complain about the quality. Now going to 24, CAF was just trying to copy Europe. Even when Europe went to 24, I had my reservation. Even the quality in 2016, Euro 2016, wasn't that much.
But I
think the quality improved in 2021. Euros, when it was 16, was the tournament to watch because you always see some kind of pairings you don't want to see in the group stage. So I don't know why we decide to go to 24 when you have a lot of boring games. Like the second game played at
over the weekend. Yeah.
Ethiopia and Kenya. I just have to skip it. I don't think I have much interest in it. So there is no innovation when it comes to CAF. It has just about copying other organizations, FIFA or UEFA. So people will have to skip a lot of games, just wait for the competition to probably get to second round or quarterfinal when it might get a bit more interesting.
And this is becoming very scary because if CAF is such a copycat, and with all these empirical facts you've given us, I'm afraid that CAF may come one day because of what UEFA is doing with this second level Europa tournament, the Europa Nations League or whatever it's called. CAF should not come one day and come with their own CAF, whatever tournament, where we'll get the like of Wiki Tories qualifying for the Continental Tournament or MFM. MFM is even a pretty decent side. No, but getting the wicked tourists of this world to go and represent Nigeria and get embarrassed. Let's hope that the tournament gives us a good game. Starting from Tuesday, when Egypt with Mo Salah would host the Nigerian Super Eagles. We'll keep you up to date, our listeners, on how the events move on. Sheyi, I will come to you here. Karim Benzema achieved a milestone in his career, notching up his 301st goals for Real Madrid over the weekend. An amazing achievement, considering the fact that in his 9 to 10 years playing with Real Madrid, he's played with the likes of Raul, who dominated the attack. He's played with Cristiano Ronaldo, who also dominated the attack. Yet he's achieved 300 goals. What, in your opinion, do you think the impact of Benzema would be? Has he always been appreciated by the likes of Florentino Perez? And I'm saying so because in spite of all this, we're still hearing the never-ending debate that Erling Haaland might come together with Kylian Mbappe, which tells me that somewhere, somehow, in spite of his years of service, this man is not earning the respect he deserves. What do you think Karim Benzema's impact will be when ultimately he leaves Real Madrid?
Kachi, I think over the years, Benzema has always been as good as he is now. but he has always been the player that has sacrificed a lot for the
team. Absolutely.
And also try as much as possible to, stay behind the major stars. Not that it wasn't as good as the major stars, but like all good teams, there's always one super player in a team. Then all others need to work together to achieve the same goal, making the team just win trophies. Even though Cristiano Ronaldo was a beast while he was in Real Madrid, but we know what Benzema and Bale was bringing to the table. Talking about Benzema over the years, I think is a definition of a modern day proper club legend. To come from a different country and stay in a particular club for up to 10 years. We don't see that, we don't see it every day. And especially in this modern day football that I think money has spoiled football nowadays. That's part of what Mourinho had issues with when he was at Man U. But let's get back to Karim Benzema. I think he has not been given the respect he deserves. Even the last year, 2021, we had this debate about him. He's supposed to be one of the people on the podium for the Ballon d'Or or the best awards, but he was overlooked. So I think he has not received enough accolade that he's supposed to receive as a player. When I see Benzema now, I'm seeing Rooney of those days that sacrificed a lot during the days of, he played with Van Nistelrooy, with Saha, with Ronaldo, with Berbatov, and always as a second striker. He puts everything on the line. He has so many assists, but we are talking of the highest goal scorer in the history of Manchester United. So that is the only way I can talk about Benzema, someone that sacrificed a lot. He has been scoring fewer goals than the key guys, but we are talking of someone that has achieved a milestone in goal scoring for a massive club in the world. Kudos to him. Now, you mentioned about what is going to happen if Haaland and Mbappe comes to Real Madrid. I think Benzema will still be the key guy there. These two guys will still need some time to also to blend into the team. And don't forget that Benzema is 34 years. So Real Madrid needs to also start planning for the future now. I think that is why they are bringing those guys in.
Thank you so much for that analysis, Shay. But you keep saying something, and I want to use that to ask a lot of ladies' question, that Benzema made a lot of sacrifices. But when I look at Benzema, it looked like he enjoyed providing goals as much as he did scoring them. Such that, in my opinion, it may not look like he was really sacrificing. I don't know whether you see it that same way, Wale. When you look at how much his numbers are providing the goals, because this is, Benzema is skillful with the ball. He can beat his man confidently when it comes to one-on-one situation. Those stepovers we love Ronaldo for, Benzema was also known for it in his younger days. Now, do you think, as Shehi also said, it's really him sacrificing his personal goals and personal statistics, or the fact that the coaches see that, I think this guy likes to make that final ball, that amazing pass, that through ball, that step over and tap in for the number nine to score. Would you also call it a sacrifice like Shea has called it? And just like I asked Shea, what do you think would become his role when and if Madrid succeed with getting Haaland and Mbappe? Wale?
Yeah, well, I think the first thing is I'm not sure how it's going to be practical for Madrid to get both Haaland and Mbappe in the next summer window. But coming to the issue of Benzema, about whether he has actually made sacrifices or probably enjoyed playing like that, I think it's a combination of both and probably a bit of circumstances. And that's why, for sometimes when I look at footballers, I don't like judging footballers by their numbers alone, because at times, a Wayne Rooney, the numbers might not do enough for a Wayne Rooney, even though the numbers are not bad. But sometimes you have to look at the circumstances. Sometimes you have to look at desire. I think desire is another thing that matters. Some of these players probably have the abilities to probably eat the higher numbers by the time you probably have to question desire. But in part of Karim Benzema, I think what really affected Benzema initially when he came into Madrid, I think in 2010 or 2011, there was a Gonzalo Higuain who he was bearing that role with. I think that early struggle between who should be the number nine, even when Pellegrini was there, he has that issue. When Mourinho took over, Mourinho had the issue too, because it has always been who is the better striker. And I think both affected each other's form and confidence at that time. And both of them looked like not too good enough. And Ronaldo probably used that and stole the whole show. By the time Higuain left and Benzema was left alone, then Ronaldo was ready an over-established superstar who everyone else within that team have to play for, either deliberately or... So I think it's a combination of both. I think circumstances, he found himself in a situation whereby I think he just have to play that second fiddle to Ronaldo because of his early struggles trying to find himself in that Real Madrid team, dragging that number nine role with Higuain. I think Higuain couldn't stand for the good of the two. Higuain had to leave. So he left. I think by the time Higuain left, Ronaldo has already taken over and he just had to do that. But from the talent we knew about Benzema right from Lyon, if Benzema has probably moved to a team where he could have a very good team, where he could be the focal point. In fact, if Benzema decided in that 2011 to move to Manchester United, not Real Madrid, we might be talking about a different numbers today.
Right. And I totally agree with you. His cerebral play, the fact that he can see and understand the movement of those people playing ahead of him makes him one of the most intelligent players. Sheyi mentioned something, and I'm going to segue straight into that. So during the course of the week, FIFA announced their shortlist, the three-man shortlist for the FIFA The Best Award. And the main three-man shortlist is Lionel Messi, Mo Salah, and Robert Lewandowski. We wish all three the best. We're probably going to wait until a week before the award itself before I ask for your take. But I'll give you 1 week to come up with your facts on who you think deserves to be, whether the all three deserve to be there, number one. Number two, who you think would be the winner. If we have time, we may come back to it. So put that at the back of your mind. I'm going to move to a question that will be close to both of you, seeing that you are both Manchester United fans. You've seen what has happened from when Ole was at the wheel to the wheelbarrow fell. And then now we have Ragnik, the creator of the gegenpress, like we know it. A lot was expected. He started his stint with a honeymoon, winning, and everybody thought, oh, okay, it looks like Ragnik would get it. Then COVID happened. Then now, struggle against Newcastle. I can't remember. I think there's one other game that struggled also against Wolves, dropping points against Wolves. It looks like the honeymoon phase is over. I've heard commenters during one of the games saying nothing really has changed from when Ole was there to now that we have Ragnik. And Sheyi, I will come to you. Has anything changed? Is there trouble in paradise? Can Ragnik, are you waiting for the 6 month caretaker role to end so that a substantive coach will come? Or do you think we should give him time like we gave Ole? Shay?
Yes, Kachi, I think it's too early to discuss about if Ragnik is the right coach or not. It's quite early. And we need to also understand the fact that there are some rumors. If at times most rumors, they have elements of truth, you know, rumors of an unsettled dressing room. And this can only be because of training regime of the coach. Now, if the players are having issues adapting to training regime, it's almost like a direct, you immediately see the direct effect on that in their matches. We've always said something about Rangnick, about his gegenpress. Do Man U players, are they going to adapt to that easily? And another thing is, does he have the right personnel to actually execute this particular gegenpress? So those things have always been on the cards when he took up this job. Now, the issue for me here is having to know that a chunk of the players are having issues with his training regime. For the game, the Newcastle game, I actually heard that the following day, they stayed late on the training ground. That particular, I think they had a match on a Monday, then on Tuesday, they stayed late. And I expect professional players, big players like Man U players, to understand that if things are not going right, if things are not going the way it should be, you should spend more time on the training ground. So if they're having issues with that, I'm highly disappointed in the players. These are players that whenever they come to the press, they talk about they are here to win trophies, they are here to do this, they are here to do that. And if you're having issues with the coach training regime, that's like contradicting yourself. So for me, I think it's early to say anything about Rangnick. He needs time to work and probably needs time to bring in some players that will understand his training regime, and gradually he starts to transform this Manchester United team. The only fear I have for this team is them losing out of the top four. That is very important for that team at the moment. Whichever way he has to do it, he needs to be in the top four. He needs to keep the Champions League ticket, because that is when he can start attracting the players that he wants.
Right. Thank you so much. Olawale, do you share Shehi's sentiments here?
Yeah, I think I partly agree with some of Shehi's take. My own, there are two things. Everything is within the hands of the United directors on what they actually want. Is even if Rangnick is not going to be there beyond the 6 months that he signed, if he's going to be working as a consultant to the team, which means we expect him to still have some significant input in what and what United do. If that is the case, I think it will be the high time, irrespective of what the result might be, for them to start backing him in terms of recruitment, in terms of who to go. Because my own opinion about the United team has always been, even though in as much as there were some tactical deficiency when it comes to Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, I think some of those United players are highly overrated. Some of them, the reason why I would not probably exonerate Ole himself was he actually contributed to probably whatever we are seeing. Players' professional treatment, we heard that, especially the English-born players. And also, he was responsible for the signing of some of these core players. He signed Wan-Bissaka, he signed Harry Maguire, and Harry Maguire should not be close to the starting lineup of any team that wants to play on the front foot. What I mean by that, any team that wants to play, that wants to dominate the game, that wants to attack their opponents constantly, such team like that, we play high-line defense. And Maguire is one of those players that is not comfortable in that role. In fact, his first instinct, when his player beats,
so hack him down.
You've seen him getting some couple of records of late. So
is responsible for bringing some of these players into. So I think United have to make a decision. They need to do a bit of clear out and probably support Rangnick, whatever he's doing. But I still have my concern on the part of Rangnick too. For me, one of the reasons why I still probably regard Carlo Ancelotti as one of the best tacticians we have in the land is we've seen Carlo Ancelotti succeeding with different players, with different style of play, different formation. There was this book, I don't know whether you guys have read, The Mixer, they were trying to relate how Roman Abramovich got about hiring, what do you call it? They say he was attracted to Ancelotti because of the kind of good football they played at AC Milan. But they said, unknown to him, that was on Carlo Ancelotti before he got to Milan. Carlo Ancelotti has always been a coach who will give, he can play a total defensive game. He can play, he has different formations, which is influenced, expensive, which is influenced by the kind of players at his disposal. So my concern on the part of Rangnick too is, it seems to be like he has zeroed his mind on a 4-2-2-2 formation without really looking at, do I have the players to fit into this formation? So, because that formation requires two holding midfielders who are comfortable on the ball and two probably playmakers who can play a bit narrow. And now, by most of these games, initially you started with, what was the name of this guy that came from Dortmund? Sancho. Mm-hmm. He started with Sancho and let me just round up. He started with Sancho and Bruno Fernandes. And Sancho likes to play more like a winger, but it's even still better. Subsequent games, we saw Rashford playing that role. We've seen Greenwood playing that role. These are not Sancho number 10. These are not guys that will look to pick a pass. They are not the golden hand. They are not the you understand? These are just guys who just want to make the runs, feed them, and score goals. You don't expect them to. So that has been one of the struggles of the team. So he himself needs to look at himself. I don't know why Donny van de Beek has not really gotten any much of it. I expected him to probably, because if you need a playmaker to play alongside Bruno Fernandes in that advance to in midfield, this is a guy who is more of a natural playmaker. I expect him to give him more play time rather than trying to force a Rashford who doesn't really have that football brain there. So it's a mixture of two things. On the part of Rangnick himself, practically, I think he's been a bit disappointing too in the way he has zeroed his mind about how he wants to play. And on the part of the players too, it just shows how overrated I think most of them are. And I think the United board have to probably design a program of clearing out some of these underachieving and overrated players.
Thank you so very much. Just before we round up, I'm going to give you just a quick roundup of the major scores as all the leagues resume after the New Year break. In this Italian Serie A, AC Milan went on a 2-game winning streak, beating Roma and also beating Venezia away from home to remain 1 point behind the league leaders, Inter Milan, who defeated Lazio over the course of the weekend. In Spain, the major news is Atletico Bilbao drawing and also Atletico Madrid drawing 2-2 with Villarreal away from home. Madrid still tops the league there, closely followed by Sevilla. And in the English FA Cup, and one of the reasons why Debo refused to join us today, Nottingham Forest defeated Arsenal 1-0 in the FA Cup. Debo, if you are listening, rest assured, next week, this is where we'll start our conversation from. But in other results, Wolves, who defeated Manchester United in the league, beat Sheffield United 3-0. West Ham defeated Leeds 2-0. Tottenham Hotspur beat Morecambe 3-1. Stoke City 2-0 over Leeds in Orient. Liverpool decimated Shrewsbury Town 4-1. Norwich City got some respite, winning 1-0 against Charlton Athletic. I think Manchester City also beat one convincingly, I think 5-1, if I remember. And I understand all the big teams have avoided each other in the next round of the FA Cup. That's pretty much our show for this week. Thank you so much for joining us and listening to us. Please stay tuned. Whatever you do, remain safe. Wash your hands. If you need to take the vaccine, take the vaccine. If you don't, maintain your hygiene and keep listening to us on News and Santos Sports, on Urban Radio Scope, and also on our podcast. Join us, like, subscribe, and comment on our YouTube channel. Until we talk to you next time, this time next week, stay blessed. Bye-bye now.